Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to begin Leviticus 19. I'm going to do the first 18 verses of this chapter. I'm going to call it "The Law is Holy and Love Your Neighbor as Yourself." Our context is this. In the previous chapter, chapter 18, we looked at all sorts of unlawful sexual relations. So now, starting in Leviticus 19, verses 1 and 2, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, and say to them, You shall be holy, for I, the Lord, am holy." Now, once again, the Lord is speaking to Moses. That phrase is repeated over and over again as we work through Leviticus. It's because God is speaking to Moses at the tent of meeting doorway, the tabernacle doorway. And sometimes he speaks to Moses and Aaron. Moses, if it doesn't mention Aaron, then of course Moses would relay the information over to Aaron. Speak to all the congregation. Well, that's over 600,000 men, not to count women and children. We're talking about a million plus people. So they couldn't be spoken to all at once. So John Gill says that they were spoken to by Moses, tribe after tribe, family after family. Moses would perambulate through the camp, talking to the tribal leaders. That's according to John Gill. Jameson Fawcett and Brown has a quotation here, quote, "Many of the laws enumerated in this chapter had been previously announced, as they were, however, of a general application, not suited to particular classes, but to the nation at large. So Moses seems, according to divine instructions, to have rehearsed them, perhaps on different occasions into successive divisions of the people, till, quote, all the congregation of the children of Israel, unquote, were taught to know them." So there was a teaching function that the leaders of Israel had to be engaged in, the priests as well as Moses, to teach the people what the law was. Now, the grand summary in verse 2 is, "Speak to them and say to them, You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." Now, that's a famous phrase, of course. Now, the term holy or holiness is a major theme of the book of Leviticus. It's the key theme of Leviticus, as the NIV Study Bible says. The word holy appears in Leviticus more than any other book in the Bible. Just in chapters 19, 20, 21, and 22, we see the word used four times. I'm not going to read them to you, but it's there. Leviticus 11, 44, and 45 is a key verse that says the same thing. "You shall be holy, for I am holy." Let's read that. Leviticus 11, 44, "For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. And you shall not make yourselves unclean with any of the swarming things that swarm on the earth. For I am the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God. Thus, you shall be holy, for I am holy." In other words, there's such a close identification between God the Father and his people that since God is holy, his people need to be holy too. Peter quotes this in the New Testament, 1 Peter 1:15, "But like the Holy One who called you," i.e. God, "be holy yourselves also in all your behavior." As God is holy, we need to be holy. We want to be holy. We want to imitate our Father, even as an earthly son likes to imitate his Father. John Gill says that we should be holy like God in his nature, his essence, and his original holiness, independently of all other worldly things, immutably like God is holy, and perfectly like God is holy. We go down to verse 3, Leviticus 19. "Every one of you shall reverence his mother and his father, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God." Now, we're going to see a lot of repetition of the Ten Commandments in the next few verses. The NIV Study Bible says that chapter 19 expands the Ten Commandments in order to detail correct morality. I guess, what's that old saying? Repetition is the key element of education. And then you say it again. Repetition is the key element of education. So we're going to repeat the Ten Commandments here. "Everyone shall reverence his mother and father." That repeats the Ten Commandment, the commandment that's given in Exodus 20:12. Honor, this is the fifth commandment, "Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you." And when I say the fifth commandment, I need to point out something that shocked me when I found out about it. The Ten Commandments are numbered differently by different groups. The Catholics have a different numbering than the Protestants, and there's other numberings too, but I'm going to give you the standard Protestant numbering. The fifth commandment, "Honor your father and mother, and you shall keep my Sabbaths," verse 3 says in Leviticus 19. That, of course, is a repetition of Exodus 28 through 11. "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy." This was a big deal. You are to labor 6 days and do all your work, but on the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You must not do any work. You, your son or daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock, or the foreigner who is within your gates. For the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and everything in them in 6 days. Then he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and declared it holy. So the Sabbath day is tied right in with the creation of the universe. The Sabbath was the sign of the Mosaic covenant. Even a circumcision was the sign of the Abrahamic covenant, and the rainbow was the sign of the Noahic covenant, and just as the bread and the wine is the sign of the new covenant. So, and since Leviticus is talking about the Mosaic law here, God repeats it. He says it. You keep my Sabbaths. I'm the Lord your God. Leviticus 19:4, we move on. Do not turn to idols and make for yourselves molten gods. I am the Lord your God. Now, this is a repetition of the first commandment, Exodus 23. You shall have no other gods before me. It's also a repetition of the second commandment, Exodus 20, verses 4 through 6. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. No idols. Leviticus 19, verses 5 through 8, we continue. Now when you offer a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord, or fellowship offerings, depending on how you translate that, you shall offer it so that you may be accepted. It shall be eaten the same day you offer it, and the next day, but what remains until the third day, shall be burned with fire. So if it is eaten at all on the third day, it is an offense. It will not be accepted. Everyone who eats it will bear his iniquity, for he has profaned the holy thing of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from his people. Cut off either means banished or executed. The scholars disagree on that, but it's serious, whatever it is. Now, the word peace offering in verse 5 is a general term because there were three types of peace offerings. There was a thanksgiving peace offering, there was a vow peace offering, and there was a free will peace offering. Let's distinguish them out real quick for review. This is all talked about in Leviticus chapter 3. The thanksgiving peace offering, the breast of it was given to all the priests. The right foreleg of it was given to the officiating priest. The rest of the meat was eaten by the offeror and whoever was invited to the fellowship meal, including the priest's family, the offeror's family, etc., etc., etc. Now, in the Thanksgiving peace offering, you had to eat all the meat the same day you offered it. The next day, boom, had to be burnt. Couldn't eat it. But here it says, you get to eat on the same day you offer it and the next day, and you don't burn what's left over till the third day. Well, that's referring to the vow and the free will peace offerings because those rules were different. You had an extra day for a vow and free will peace offering. And so Leviticus 19:6 is talking about the vow and free will offering. And of course, it's easy to reason from that. If you screw up a Thanksgiving peace offering and eat it on the second day, well, you're just as unclean. You're going to be cut off too, just like if you were cut off by messing up the vow and the free will offering. We can also, I mentioned Leviticus 3, where the rules about the peace offerings are. You can also look in Leviticus 7 and see some of that, some of the other rules also. Now the question is why did you have to eat the meat of a peace offering before the allotted days ran out? Why? Here's some options. Option 1, meat spoiled quickly in the hot desert. If you didn't eat the meat quickly, the offering would become rotten and thus defiled. In other words, you couldn't throw the leftovers in the fridge because they didn't have fridges back then. Second reason why the meat had to be eaten promptly, this is John Gill's idea, it would encourage liberality to the priest because since you had to eat all the meat up and there were no leftovers, if you had a lot of meat and you couldn't eat it, you say, well, let's invite some more people over so we can get rid of all this food. And so then some priests and Levites might be eating them. That will help the priest out because they, of course, had no income. They got their living from the offerings. Third possibility why the offerors and the priest had to eat the meat promptly before the days ran out was to prevent a superstitious notion that there was some virtue or holiness in the offered meat. In other words, if they kept the meat and let it last, they'd say, oh, this is something special. Let's rub it. Let's kiss it. Let's make an idol out of it. That's Jameson Fawcett Brown's idea. Nope, can't do that because it's going to be eaten up. Now, this prohibition about not leaving meat of a sacrifice left over, it applied to the Passover lamb, too, Exodus 12:10. And you shall not leave any of it over until morning, but whatever is left of it until morning you shall burn with fire. You had even less time to eat a Passover. You had to eat it the day you offered it. A Thanksgiving peace offering, you had, well, the same thing. You had to eat it the same day. On the second day, you had to burn what was left over. So a Passover offering was like a Thanksgiving peace offering. Now the question arises is why did you only get one day to eat the Thanksgiving peace offering, and then you had to burn off everything the next day? Why did you get 2 days to eat the vow peace offering and the free will peace offering? Well, the only reason I could come up with is from the commentator Ellicott. This is what he says, quote, "As both these votive offerings," referring to the vow and the free will offering, "were an indirect mode of supplication having respect to future favors, and hence were not a spontaneous expression of pious devotion, they were not so sacred as the former." Now, what Ellicott is saying here is that a vow offering was generally offered this way: God, if you will help me win this battle, I'll give you a peace offering. Or God, if you will let me obtain this young woman in marriage, I'll give you a peace offering. And a free will offering was similar to that. You don't make a vow that if something happens in particular, but what you do is you pray, God, please let something good happen to me in the future. There's no promise to make an offering, but the idea is I'm making this offering and I'm praying along with it. Something that I've effect that, so that, as Ellicott says, those two offerings were an indirect mode of supplication having respect to future favors. But now, a Thanksgiving offering was not in response to a prayer for future prayers. It was in response to something already happening, just kind of like serendipity happening to the offeror, or something great's happened. I just won the lottery, well, or you know, something like that. Something good has happened. Had a good crop that came in. I want to give Thanksgiving to God. And so that Thanksgiving peace offering was considered a cut above, and it was more holy, and therefore you had less time to let that meat get rotten in the heat. We go now to Leviticus 19, 9 and 10. "Now when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest." Now we're going to get into loving your neighbor laws. Verse 10, Leviticus 19, "Nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God." Now when it says in verse 9, "And when you reap the harvest of your land," that's referring to the land of Canaan, as John Gill points out. Obviously, the Israelites weren't harvesting anything while they were in the desert. This is referring to the future when they get to Canaan. "When they get there, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest." There's two different things here, both having one purpose, is to leave something over for the poor. If you reap and you just go all the way to the very edge of the field, the very corners of the field, there's not going to be anything left over for the poor. Nor the gleanings, that's when you reap and you're tying everything into bundles and there's pieces of the grain that fall down on the ground. Well, don't go scooping them all up and sweeping it all up and sticking them in another bundle maybe, or adding to it a pre-existing bundle, because you're not leaving anything for the poor. So don't do that. Verse 19 says, "Nor shall you glean your vineyard." Now John Gill says, this is how you glean a vineyard. You cut off the little clusters, which were small compared to the normal clusters. That's a little different than grapes that fall to the ground. In both cases, you're not supposed to go around cutting off the small clusters or picking up the grapes that are falling on the ground. Notice there's two things here in verse 10. "Nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit." So leave something for the poor, for the needy, and for the stranger. The stranger not likely to having... He's a sojourner in the land. He probably doesn't have a fixed field. He probably doesn't have fields that he can go plant and make some money off of. In fact, a lot of sojourners were doing business trade in Israel, and they wouldn't have food to eat, could be, and so they're provided for. That's an example of loving your neighbor. We're going to get to the famous love your neighbor verse in just a minute. Now, there were some restrictions on this gleaning. Jameson Fawcett and Brown points out, first, the poor could be kept out of the field until the harvest was complete, so they wouldn't interfere with the harvest. Two, the owners could choose the poor they felt the most deserving. In other words, if somebody's poor because he's a drunken bum, he's been beating his wife and smoking dope, well, we can keep them out and let somebody that's poor, through no fault of their own, let the deserving poor in the field to glean. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says that this law of gleanings was, quote, "the earliest law for the benefit of the poor that we read of in the code of any people." Now, that is interesting. If you read Hammurabi's code or some of these old ancient Near Eastern codes, like a Sumer and Akkadian and all those places, They don't have anything about helping out the poor, but the Hebrew Scriptures did. Jameson Foster Brown also point out that the hearts of the rich would be strongly inclined to liberality at harvest time, because that's when the gleanings take place, and there's a lot of stuff left over. And that really is true. If you got friends that grow gardens, boy, they're real generous right around harvest time. They got so much vegetables they don't know what to do with, and they're giving them to all their friends. You got tomatoes all over the place and squash. It's not because they all of a sudden have become more generous. It's because they got too much crops. They're trying to get rid of them. So this is a good time to help the poor is when it's time to harvest. That's when you do your gleaning. We go now to Leviticus 19:11. You shall not steal, nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another. Well, not stealing, that's the repetition of the eighth commandment that says, quote, you shall not steal. That's an easy one. Almost every culture, in all times and all places, it's really amazing. They have a strong sense of private property. You distinguish carefully between what's thine and what's mine. Don't deal falsely to one another. Here's some examples of that. John Gill says, fraud in business. Well, I'm sure there's other ways you can deal falsely with someone. Like in romance, oh my gosh, I'm not married. Don't lie to one another. Now, Exodus 20:16, which is one of the commandments, says you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, and that probably refers to perjury in court. It could refer to slander, maybe, outside of court. Leviticus 19:11 says you shall not lie to one another. Period. End of story. Whether it's in court, well, to one another means to each other. It doesn't refer to perjury, because perjury in court, you're not speaking to another Israelite. You put all those laws together and you don't lie in court, you don't commit perjury, you don't slander people. That's easy enough. However, I must say that defining a lie, what a lie is, presents all sorts of ethical problems. I remember taking an ethics course with Norman Geisler, the well-known apologist who wrote a great book on ethics, and he was constantly bringing up all these hard cases. How do you handle that when it says don't lie? And I remember, this is not an easy question. Let me give you some hard issues that come up. What about a patient that asks his doctor if he's going to die, and the doctor just avoids the question? He didn't actually lie, did he? What if the patient insists, Doc, I want you to tell me, am I going to die or not? Is the doctor, because he's scared that if he tells the patient the bad news that that will actually hasten his death, should the doctor keep quiet? How about the Chinese overseas student in America who calls back to their parents at home? Hey, Mom, how's Dad? Of course, Dad's got about a week to live. He's ravaged with cancer. Oh, he's doing fine, sweetie. No problem. I've seen that happen about a million times. Chinese people will not tell their kids about, or vice versa. The kids overseas will not tell their parents, oh, I'm sick as a dog. I might die. No, they're not going to say anything about it. I think that what happens in those cases, either the parent or the child talks to relatives and gets the news indirectly. Is that a lie when a parent or child does that in order to save grief to their relative? How about this? The press asks a question of the president, which, if the president answers it, will get an intelligence agent killed somewhere overseas. The president going to do that? Is that a justifiable lie? What about this? You're in World War II. Nazi points his gun at you after he bursts through the door, and he says, where are you hiding the Jews in this house? And you've got Jews in the house. Do you tell the truth to the Nazi? What about this? A government puts false information in the press to mislead enemy intelligence operations during time of war, or even during time of peace, for that matter. So you lie to the press. Is that justifiable? How about this? The Hebrew midwives misled the Egyptian authorities about the fact that they had not killed Hebrew boys because the Hebrew boys were born so fast they couldn't get to them. Which is an outright lie, a bald-faced lie. Were the Hebrew midwives sinning when they did that? They were never chastised for it. They allowed the Israelites to flourish when they otherwise would have been wiped out. How about this? The pagan Rahab, she's in Jericho when the Israelites approach the Jordan River, getting ready to go into the Promised Land. They sent two soldiers over the line, over the Jordan, into Rahab's place of business there. And then Rahab hid them. I think she hid them on her roof under some wood or something. I forgot which. She hid them. And so then the pagan people of the land came to Rahab and said, where are the Hebrew spies? And Rahab lied, and she's written up in the Hebrews Hall of Fame in chapter 11 for doing that. So this is not an easy question. But I must say that hard cases make bad law. The general rule is very easy. Don't lie. If you don't have a very, very, very good reason for lying, I can at least say that. Don't lie. Now, there's some Christians who say you never lie, period, absolutist. And I like, okay, if you're an absolutist, I say, okay, well, if I'm playing basketball and I fake left and then drive right, have I not deceived my fellow human being playing on the other side of the ball? If you want to be absolute about it, we can take it to absurd extremes. Let's go to Leviticus 19:12. You shall not swear falsely by my name, so as to profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. Now, this is a repetition of one of the commandments, Exodus 27. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Now, there's some ways you could swear falsely. You could swear falsely in court, commit perjury. Or you could deliberately lie to someone to get an agreement. I'm not married. Will you marry me? Oh, I've got plenty of capital to back up this business. I've got $1 million in government bonds. Will you sign the partnership agreement? That would be swearing falsely. And that would be, I swear, more like this. I swear by God, in God's name, I promise you on a stack of Bibles, I promise you by God, I've got that money. It's a lie. You've just profaned the name of the Lord your God. How about rash or vain oaths in common conversation? The kings of England, I'm thinking of Edward I right now, he would say things like, by God's eye, you shall not have that castle. Another one was, by God's thigh, I think that was Henry II that liked to do that a lot. By God's leg. I said, it's nonsense. God doesn't have pieces of a body, and it's just indelicate. It's inappropriate. It's rude. It's blasphemous to take God's name that way to make an oath. So we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't swear falsely. Now, if you say, I swear by God, I will tell the truth in this court. Now, that's not swearing falsely. That's a perfectly okay oath. We'll go to Leviticus 19:13. You shall not oppress your neighbor, nor rob him. The wages of a hired man are not to remain with you all night until morning. Now, there was a reason for this. This is assuming day laborers. They're common laborers, so they're poor. They don't have savings. They're living hand to mouth, as Adam Clark said. If you were late even one day in paying them, that means they could buy food for the next day. They don't have any cushion. They don't have any buffer. So that means, by golly, you better pay him every day. Don't let his wages stay with you, boss man, all night long and then pay him in the morning. No, you pay him at night. If you wait to the next day to pay him, well, he's got to go to work the next day. Where's he going to go out and have time to buy food? When's he going to have time to eat it? No, you pay him. Now, this is assuming day laborers here in this verse, but the same principle would apply to somebody hired by the week or by the month. I remember my father was in the construction business, and he would pay his laborers every week. And I remember him saying, you can miss a payment on paying interest to the bank. You can miss a payment in paying a payment to a supplier. But by golly, you cannot miss payroll. I mean, if you have to borrow money to pay payroll because you have cash flow problems, well, then you borrow the money and pay and make payroll. You have to make payroll. You have to pay the workers. Are they going to quit? In the modern case, in the Levitical case, they might quit, but they also might starve to death. So this was a big deal in the law and in also even in the New Testament. Let's look at Deuteronomy 24:14-15. You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your countrymen or one of your aliens who is in your land and your towns. You shall give him his wages on his day before the sun sets, for he is poor and sets his heart on it, so that he will not cry against you to the Lord and it becomes sin in you. You get delay even one day, it's a sin, and he's going to be crying bloody murder. He's going to be pleading with God for justice and his money. Jeremiah 22:13. Woe to him who builds his house without righteousness and his upper rooms without justice, who uses his neighbor's services without pay and does not give him his wages. Pay your bills, folks. That's basically what the law is saying. This is easy morality here. How about Matthew 20:8? This is in one of the parables. When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last group to the first. Pay them their wages. That wasn't the main point of the parable, but it illustrates the practice of paying in the evening. When evening came, pay them their wages, because most laborers back then were day laborers. We go now to Leviticus 19:14. You shall not curse a deaf man, nor place a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall revere your God, I am the Lord. Now, it takes some kind of a cad to curse a deaf man or to put a stumbling block before a blind man who's trying to find his way around. You deliberately make him trip, and you would think that wouldn't happen very often. So why is it in the law? Well, let's see what Jameson Fawcett Brown says why it's in the law. I'll tell you, he says it's because the law did not want people ridiculing bodily infirmities. Let me read you his quote. A variety of social duties are inculcated in this passage, chiefly in reference to common and little thought of vices to which mankind are exceedingly prone, such as committing petty frauds or not scrupling to violate truth in transactions of business, ridiculing bodily infirmities, or circulating stories to the prejudice of others, gossip. Ridiculing bodily infirmities, says Jameson Fawcett Brown. I don't think, though, that that's the idea here in this law. Adam Clark agrees. He says that the main idea is the thought that one should not take advantage of someone's weakness. If you curse a deaf man and say, you lied, you cheated, you robbed me, of course people are going to hear this. The deaf man can't hear what you're saying, so he can't respond to the charges to vindicate himself. John Gill mentions that one too. Stumbling block before the blind has the same idea. You're taking advantage of his weakness, making him fall so he can't hurt you or he can't come after you. So to abstract from this a little bit, basically the idea is if you have an advantage over somebody because they're hurting, don't take advantage of them. Now, in business, how many movies, if I like to watch these old Hollywood movies, and you got all these capitalists in a boardroom and they're threatened to merge or buy out somebody's business and he's had hard times, his business is on the rocks or it's had a setback and he's just pitiful. And I remember seeing one, the guy sold out, walked out of the boardroom, and all of a sudden everybody in the boardroom hears this bang as the guy shoots himself and kills himself because he was taken advantage of. Yeah, don't do that. In other words, if you're going to buy somebody out, let it be a legitimate economic transaction where the person receiving money for his failing business is helped because his business would bankrupt anyway, and so you buy him out and you get his assets, but he gets a little bit of money too, so it's not like he's robbed. I'm not saying that business is a welfare organization or a charitable organization, but on the other hand, don't try to screw people to the wall when they're temporarily weak. That would be a good application of this verse. Paul was probably thinking of this verse when he said in Romans 14:13, therefore let us not judge one another anymore, but rather determine this, not to put an obstacle or a stumbling block in a brother's way. He perhaps was referring to Leviticus 19:14, our verse. Now let's go to Leviticus 19:15. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. Now, in judgment is referring to legal situations with regard to judges and witnesses. In other words, if you're a judge, give just judgment. Don't do injustice in the courts. Now, this verse has always been extremely interesting to me because the verse says don't be partial to the poor and don't defer to the great either. You're not supposed to be partial to the great. Well, we all know that. It's legendary how people with fancier lawyers and rich lawyers end up with better defenses than somebody that's right out of law school and has been appointed pro bono. And we all know the stories of judges who've been bribed so that they will defer to the great and show partiality to the great. And that's true in all legal systems. It's always a problem. But this verse says, goes the other way also and says, don't be partial to the poor. Now, why might a judge favor a poor person? John Gill says it might be pity. Here's the quote from Gill, quote, the poor person, he may be pitied in other respects, but in a cause between him and another, even a rich man, not pity, but justice must take place. In other words, justice is completely divorced from the bank account, the size of the bank account of the people involved in court actions. And that's the way it ought to be. That's a hard standard to meet, but it's a good standard to have. Justice really is supposed to be blind. And when you mention don't be partial to the poor, that really drives the point home because that's something we don't normally think about. Warning a judge not to be partial to the poor person because poor people don't pay bribes. We go now to Leviticus 19:16. Well, I can think of another example of a judge being partial to a poor person. What happens if the poor person is somehow related to him or related to a friend and he's in trouble against a rich litigant opposing him at law? and the judge has family or personal ties to the poor guy. Well, there's an example of how a judge can be partial to the poor. Of course, if it looks bad, he ought to recuse himself, but anyway, got to be impartial. Leviticus 19:16. You shall not go about as a slanderer among your people, and you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. Now, the phrase or the word that means go about, as Gill and Clark point out, that word refers to a trader, a peddler who goes from place to place selling things. And so the idea is don't go around peddling slanders among your people. Don't go house to house slandering people. And that's what people with a big mouth do. They're not content just to tell one person the dirt. They got to tell everybody. I just saw a documentary where Lauren Bacall, the famous Hollywood movie actress, was engaged to Frank Sinatra. And they were about to get married, and all of a sudden Frank Sinatra found out that Lauren Bacall had told the press about their wedding plans. And that was not slander, but it was being indiscreet with one's mouth. And so Frank Sinatra says, nope, Lauren, that's it. No more. Marriage off. There are lots and lots of proverbs about watching your tongue. The tongue is a dangerous fire, a world of iniquity and all that. Keep your mouth shut. The more you keep it shut, the happier you are. And I know sometimes you got to speak. But be slow to speak. You'd be happier. But this is not just talking about inadvertent slips of the tongue, or which everybody does every once in a while. This is where you are deliberately slandering somebody, defaming them with your tongue. You're not to act against the life of your neighbor. Now, it doesn't say that slander is acting against the life of your neighbor, but it is very close to that. You slander somebody's reputation, that's the sort of stuff that can cause people to commit suicide. It's serious business. That old saying, sticks and stones can hurt my bones, but words can never hurt me, is an absolute lie. I don't know how it got crystallized into a proverb. It's not true. You don't slander people. You're not to act against the life of your neighbor. John Gill gives some examples of how you can act against the life of your neighbor. Slandering is one thing I just said, but also give false witness in court, perjuring, harming a litigant with perjured testimony. Not testifying in favor of an innocent man or a non-liable defendant. You've got facts that would exonerate a defendant and you don't speak up. Ooh, that's bad. You're acting against the life of your neighbor. How about this? Not helping a man in trouble to the best of your ability. For example, you see a man drowning, you say, I'm going to let him drown. And you know how to swim. And you know how to rescue people that's drowning. How about this? A thief is breaking into your neighbor's house and you don't call the cops. How about this? A bear attacks your fellow tent mate in a national park, and you just watch it instead of making noise and screaming and hollering, trying to get the bear to cease and desist. Now, you've got to be careful here. I'm assuming that the person who is called to help the man in trouble, or to help the person in trouble, he has the ability to give that help. For example, if there's somebody drowning and you don't know how to swim, well, it'd be stupid for you to go out and try to help him, because not only would the drowning person drown, but the person who's trying to help would drown also. What good does that accomplish? Also, if a thief has a gun pointed at you, he says, I'm going to rob your neighbor's house. And I say, no, you better not do that. And I get myself shot. So what good does that do? I get myself killed and the property is still stolen. Or what happens if a wild beast is attacking my neighbor's tent and I go up to the wild beast and say, come on, bear, let's have a fight here. I'm going to take you out. Well, that's stupid. This issue of helping people in trouble actually caused a big legal problem, and now most states have passed what are called Good Samaritan laws that protect bystanders who do not help people in trouble. And you say, well, that's not what Leviticus says. Well, here's what happened. Let's say somebody's drowning. I go out and try to rescue him. I don't do a good job of it. The person drowns. The person's surviving relatives then sue me for negligence because I didn't do a good rescue. Well, when that word gets around, guess what? Then it's not going to be anybody jumping in the water to rescue anybody if they're going to get saved. This actually happened in China about 10 years ago, I think it was. Somebody, some kid or something, some young child was getting kidnapped on a street. I forgot which city it was. And nobody went to rescue the child, and the whole nation was in an uproar. How can people be so callous and let that happen? Well, it turns out just before that, the Chinese government had gotten, or the Chinese court system, I should say, had gotten a Chinese person in a lot of trouble, caused him a lot of financial damage because he tried to rescue somebody and failed. And the news was everywhere. Everybody knew it. And so they just let the baby sit there. So we've got to be a little bit careful about saying acting against the life of your neighbor is failing to act when your neighbor's in trouble. In general, if you have the ability, you should, but there are some exceptions, all of which I've gone over just now. Now let's finish up with Leviticus 19, verses 17 and 18. We'll finish this audio. You shall not hate your fellow countryman in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. In other words, by hating him, you incur sin, bring sin on yourself. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Now, this is the famous verse. Of course, it's quoted many, many times in the New Testament. It's Leviticus 19:18. Let's start in verse 17, where the law says, you shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. This idea is reflected in the New Testament, especially in 1 John. 1 John 2:9, the one who says he is in the light and yet hates his brother is in the darkness until now. 1 John 2:11, but the one who hates his brother is in the darkness and walks in the darkness and does not know where he is going because the darkness has blinded his eyes. 1 John 3:15, everyone who hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. 1 John 4:20, if someone says, I love God and hates his brother, he is a liar. For the one who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. Now, John, in his letter of 1 John, equates hating your brother with walking in darkness, with being a murderer, with being a liar, and someone who does not love God. So it's serious business to hate your brother. Now, verse 17 in Leviticus 19 says, you shall not hate your fellow countrymen. King James and the NIV have neighbor. You shall not hate your neighbor. Now, normally we would say, okay, that's anybody. John in 1 John was talking about fellow Christians. Well, what the Jews did, and they're good at this kind of thing, they said, nah, you're not supposed to hate anybody that's a fellow Jew. But if it's somebody else, like an Ammonite, a Moabite, or a Samaritan, we can hate them. That's not what the verse means. The word fellow countryman means anyone with whom one comes in contact, obviously. We don't want a pharisaical rabbinical interpretation of this verse. Jameson Fawcett Brown is a commentator who said the Israelites later restricted the meaning to their own countrymen rather than other people. And those commentators say that the word should be here, fellow creature. You shall not hate your fellow creature. I don't know if they would say that's a better translation or a better meaning. Either way, it's not merely a fellow Jew. And of course, Jesus famously rebuked this narrow interpretation of the Pharisees in the parable of the Good Samaritan. You recall that? Who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Well, the question was asked of him, because I don't want to love somebody who's not my neighbor. And Jesus picked the Samaritan as someone who the Jews hated. He says, that's the guy. He's your neighbor. And he was the one that showed more mercy than anybody, including all these priests that walked up on this wounded man and just walked on the other side and let him go. So just because you're a Jew doesn't mean a thing, but a Samaritan? No. He's your neighbor. He felt compassion. Which of these three? The first two was a priest. The first two was a Levite. They ignored the wounded man, walked on the other side. Then the Good Samaritan helped the wounded man. And Jesus said, which of these three proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell into the robber's hands? And of course, that was the Samaritan, the Good Samaritan. That's who your neighbor is. So you shall not hate anybody, not even Democrats. Oh, excuse me if you're a Democrat. I'm so sorry. But you're not supposed to hate Democrats. You're not supposed to hate Trump supporters. You're not supposed to hate communists. You're not supposed to hate racists. You're not supposed to hate anybody. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't pray for judgment to come on these people and punish them for their sins. That's a different thing. In fact, it says right here in the next verse, you may surely reprove your neighbor. I just had a dream last night where three kids were up in a pine tree that was on my yard in my childhood home, and they had three placards. The first two placards were KK, and the third one, which I thought was going to be KKK, but for some reason it wasn't. But I could see the kids were up to no good, and I started screaming at them and saying, you are advocating hatred of people and murdering people. Get off my property. Well, I had every right to do that in my dream. I was reproving my neighbor. You can do that, but you can't hate. Just like when the person pulls the switch on the electric chair, the executioner, he's not supposed to hate the person, the murderer who's being executed. That's justice. There's no personal vengeance in this thing. Likewise, when a governor signs a death warrant, no personal vengeance or hatred. Now, I know that's hard to do, but nonetheless, that's the way it's supposed to be. This has nothing to do with justice and courts. Verse 18 says, you shall not take vengeance. That's talking about private vengeance, revenge, hatred in your heart, bearing a grudge. No, you're not supposed to do that. But this has nothing to say about a court or a police system wreaking justice, not vengeance, but wreaking justice on criminals. It has nothing to do with that. Verse 17 says, you may surely reprove your neighbor. In other words, you can't hate him in your heart secretly, but you can speak to him. It's not a sin to tell sinning people that they're sinning. There's too many Christians who think it is. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown have to say about that. Quote, instead of cherishing latent feelings of malice or meditating purposes of revenge against a person who has committed an insult or injury against them, God's people were taught to remonstrate with the offender and endeavor by calm and kindly reason to bring him to a sense of his fault. Yes, you can talk, you can reason, but you don't hate. And if you're in the court system, you can administer justice. As Paul said in Romans 13, God gave the sword to the government. Swords are not used to cook pancakes on, folks. Sword, that was a symbol of capital punishment. But you're not supposed to hate the criminal that you capitally execute. You're not supposed to hate anybody in your heart. Jesus said that in Matthew 5, 21 and 22. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. Now note the asymmetry between love and hate. Love is not love till you show it. Hate is hatred even if you don't show it. I came up with this. I think I did, unless I stole it from somewhere else and forgot. But I think that's pretty good. Let me say that again. The asymmetry of love and hate. Love is not love till you show it. Hate is hatred even if you don't show it. Now one more theological issue and we'll shut this audio down. Matthew 5, 21 and 22a, Jesus says this on the Sermon on the Mount. This is in the middle of his six antitheses. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder. But I say to you, everyone who's angry is guilty. Now the question is, who are these ancients that Jesus was speaking? Now the reason this is theologically relevant is that Reformed covenant theologians cannot and will not say that Jesus in any way monkeyed with the Mosaic law to change the moral law of the Mosaic law. And so they say the Old Testament law says don't hate and Jesus says don't hate. No change. Well, if Jesus is quoting the Levitical law, Moses as an ancient, well then Moses said don't hate in your heart in Leviticus right here, and then Jesus says don't hate in your heart, so there is no change between the Mosaic law and the New Testament law. But if Jesus is quoting the Pharisees here, and the Pharisees somehow only referring to the outward act of murder, but not the inward heart attitude of murder, then Jesus is not changing Moses. Well, if you take the formal position that Jesus does not change Moses, then you're a Reformed covenant theologian. If you take the view that in the antitheses in the Sermon on the Mount that Jesus is indeed promulgating a new law and putting the Mosaic law on the shelf and replacing it with New Covenant law, then you're a New Covenant theologian. Well, I'm New Covenant. I don't believe in the covenant view. I believe in the New Covenant view, but you see right here, I've got a problem. Now, it can be answered, but I'm not going to get into that. I've done a lot of stuff on New Covenant theology, but I do point it out to you in case you want to explore some theology a little further. Now, in verse 18, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. The reason that's so familiar is that both Jesus and Paul quoted that verse a lot. Here's Jesus, Matthew 22:39. The second commandment is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Mark 12:31. The second commandment is this. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There's no other commandment greater than those two commandments. Loving your God is the first commandment. Luke 10:27. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. There's the first and second commandments. Paul quoted the Leviticus 19:18, Romans 13:9, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, it is summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So Paul quotes Leviticus 19:18. Galatians 5:14, for the whole law is fulfilled in one word, in the statement, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. James 2:8, if however you are fulfilling the royal law, that's the law of Christ, according to the scripture of Christ the King, if you're fulfilling that, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You're doing well. Now, here's an interesting factoid here from the NIV Study Bible. the stricter school of the Pharisees, that's the Shammai school, not the Hillel school, but the Shammai school, they added to this verse, hate your enemy. You shall love your neighbor as yourself, and you're supposed to hate your enemy. The law didn't say that. There's a perfect example of people adding to the scripture and coming up with something that's the exact opposite of what the scripture means. All right, we'll finish up verse 18 with a small problem here. Problem occasioned by John 13, verse 34. A new commandment, Jesus says, I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. Well, Jesus obviously is quoting Leviticus 19:18 there, but he calls this commandment to love one's neighbor as a new commandment. He says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. How is it new? It's all obvious that the command was in Leviticus first, so how can Jesus say it's new? Well, I think it's the idea that now we're supposed to show positive love. The Old Testament law was basically don't do bad things to your neighbor. Don't lie against them. Don't deal with them falsely. Don't do that kind of thing. But here it's we affirmatively go out and love our brother. We show our love. We don't just refrain from hurting our brother, but we actually help our brother. I remember somebody one time said that the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, is repeated a lot of times in other cultures and religions negatively. I remember Confucius actually said this negatively. He says, don't do unto somebody else what you don't want them to do to you. Well, now that's different than do to somebody else what you would have done to you. Now you are affirmatively going out and trying to do the best for somebody else, to help other people. And there's nothing more blessed to do that than help people, to love them by doing good things to them, didn't Paul say? It is more blessed to give. Actually, Paul's quoting Jesus in Acts, I think it's Acts 18. He says, it is more blessed to give than receive. It's actually Acts 20, verse 35. So, when Jesus says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another, Jesus is talking about going out and doing something for somebody else, because he refers to himself as loving. He says, even as I have loved you, he's referring to his coming crucifixion. He laid his life down for the church. That's a positive thing. He just didn't refrain from killing the Christians who followed him. He didn't refrain from doing evil to the Christians who followed him. He actually went out and affirmatively did something positive. He died for them. So that's why it's a new commandment. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Leviticus 19, verse 18. In our next audio, I'm going to take up some miscellaneous laws in verses 19 through 37, the end of the chapter. I hope you stay tuned for that. And I hope you enjoyed this audio.